From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Pulitzer Prize winner Steve Faneroo is my guest. He's a reporter for ESPN, and along with co-author, his brother Mark, he's the author of the book League of Denial, The NFL, Concussions, and the Battle for Truth, a book about traumatic brain injury in the NFL and the league's resistance to accepting responsibility. He's also the author of the PBS Frontline documentary on the subject. Steve Faneroo, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Gary.
Has this investigation like ruined your appreciation of football?
You'd think that it might, but in fact, it really hasn't had, well, I think it's had a more subtle effect than maybe I would have imagined. On the one hand, I'm watching more football than ever. You know, I have season tickets to the 49ers. 49ers are now in the NFC Championship game. You know, I spent the weekend watching, you know, more football than I probably should. And so in that sense, I don't feel like my love for the sport really is any way diminished. I think it's just an unbelievable sport. You know, the athletes are so incredibly gifted. And, you know, as Mike Oriard said, you know, it's sort of a combination of, you know, violence and ballet. And I have just a really deep appreciation for that. At the same time, I do think that, you know, my brother and I, we know a lot now about the effects that these collisions have on the players who entertain us. And it's devastating. It's devastating not only to many of them, but it's also devastating to the people who love them and the people who end up living with their misery, which is not too strong of a word, I think, to describe it. And I think that, you know, I think for me, like some many fans, I think now that's producing a kind of a disconnect, which is sort of how much can we as fans tolerate, and what's the threshold for the amount of damage that's being caused in the sport before we begin to turn away? And we're not nearly there yet, but I do think that as the science progresses and we learn more about how many players are coming down with these injuries, that's going to become a bigger and bigger question.
It is interesting, having read your book and seen the film. I'm watching football and I see these guys and I realize, you know, all the stuff that's going on. And yet the guys who love each other, they smash each other in the head, like affectionately whack each other on the...
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think, oh, no, that's another...
Don't do it. Even these guys who are, you know, don't even have their helmets on, you know, they get caught up in the fray.
In the head whacking.
Yeah, you know, it's insane. But that's the sport, right?
Right.
I mean, it's just a violent, violent game. And I think that's one of the things that we really tried to describe as graphically as possible in our book, you know, how violent a sport this really is. And, you know, I hope that we captured that, because I don't think it's fully conveyed even when we watch it on television. It's more of this, you know, incredibly well choreographed reality show that we all watch. And but I do think the violence of it in many ways is sanitized, you know, for our enjoyment. And in some ways that makes it what's happened even more perverse, I think.
Well, let me ask you this bottom line question then before we get into the meat of League of Denial. If you're a high-paid athlete and you know what the risks are and there's a market for your talent and you love the game, then why shouldn't you play the game?
Well, I think Mark and I have been arguing that, you know, when we get asked this question. You know, I do think there has been a perception among some people who have read the book or seen the film that Mark and I sort of set out to be the ones who led the charge to change football, kill football. And I think that, you know, that obviously that for us, I mean, that's not true. But more than that, I think the issue is one of information. And I think what we're trying to convey is that the NFL, as a corporate entity, sought to bury this information for a long, long period of time. And that's where the insidious nature of what was going on took place. It wasn't so much that, you know, you have these players who, you know, who know what they're getting into and should have known. In fact, they didn't know. No one really knew until the until the late 80s or early 90s when this began to some of this scientific work began to be done. And the NFL's response to it was to try to bury it and hide it from the players and the fans. Now, what the players do with that information is a completely different story. And I think you're right. I think it's a logical argument that some people are making now. You know, now that they know, now that the players know, you know, why shouldn't they have the right to go out and do it? And I think Mark and I feel that way, at least at the professional level. When you get down to kid football, which, you know, basically up through high school, I think it's a completely different proposition. And I think that's something that people are and should take a very hard look at.
Absolutely, sure. If you're a kid, it's harder to make those decisions. And
right.
And as you point out in the film and book, that a 14-year-old brain has not developed in the same way that an adult brain has.
Exactly.
I did speak with Sam McCollum. He was a NFL player for the Vikings. He went to the Super Bowl in 1975, and he then played for the Seahawks. And he told me he believes that the NFL has taken very good care of him.
In no way would I try to dispute someone's individual experience in the National Football League, which is an experience that I have not had. But what I would say is that I do think when I look at the body of evidence that's presented in our book, that the National Football League as a corporate entity, that involved itself in scientific research, I think that they did a grave disservice to their players and their fans by failing to provide and even hiding this information. Now, I think that a lot of people, I think a lot of players, if you ask them, would you do it all over again knowing what you know now, the great majority of them would say, of course I would. You know, it was the most thrilling and in many ways rewarding experience of my life, and many players do say that. But I do think that there are also, and we've talked to them, there are a number of players who don't feel that way, who feel that the NFL did not serve them well and feel that they're paying a price for it now later in their life.
We're talking with Steve Faneru, and he, along with his brother Mark, is the co-author of this book called League of Denial, The NFL, Concussions, and the Battle for the Truth. And your investigation really begins, I guess, with the death of Pittsburgh Steeler great Mike Webster. He was 50 years old. How did his death spur this investigation?
Well, Webster was the first player to be diagnosed with this neurodegenerative disease that's known as CTE, which stands for chronic traumatic encephalopathy. It's a progressive brain disease that scientists believe is caused by head trauma, and in these cases, the repetitive head trauma that's associated with football. And Webster, before he died, literally went crazy. You know, he was one of the most respected players on those Steeler dynasty, on the Steeler Super Bowl teams, the four Super Bowl teams in the 70s. Webster was the anchor of those teams. He was the center. He was literally the strongest man in the league. You know, he was a pillar of the community in Pittsburgh. People loved him because they identified him with the blue-collar ethos of the city. But later in his life, he became a completely different person when you talk to his family. He couldn't control himself. He had no conception about how to handle money. He flew into bouts of rage against his family and his old friends, his old teammates. He became sort of almost transient, living in bus stations, living out of his car. He wrote thousands upon thousands of letters, a few of which are included in the book, in which he basically tried to tell anybody who would listen that football was really wreaking havoc on his brain. And then when he died at the age of 50, his brain was autopsied, and there was a neuropathologist who happened to be working that day named Bennett Amalu, who became curious about what had happened to Webster, and he decided to save his brain for study. And when he examined his brain, he found this this disease, CTE, which had not been discovered in an NFL player. It was something that had been known really since the 1920s in boxers, but it had never been diagnosed in NFL players. And so when it happened, for many neuroscientists who were familiar with this disease and were familiar with the ramifications, they knew immediately that this was going to be something that was huge and was something that the NFL was going to have to deal with.
Well, in the film, there's some pictures of Mike Webster's body that are pretty hard to take. And he's extreme. I mean, his legs, so how can we be sure that what happened to him? He was also, according to your book, you know, taking a lot of drugs, and he was busted for, fake prescriptions and so forth. How do
Right.
we know that football is the thing that's responsible?
Well, what the neuroscientists will tell you is there really is no other cause that could be behind this protein that's accumulated in the regions of the brain where it was found in with Webster. This protein tau, which is called tau, builds up neurofibrillary tangles which essentially strangle the neurons in one's brain, and it's associated with Alzheimer's disease, but in Webster it had appeared in different places of his brain that you would associate with Alzheimer's. There were also no traces of beta amyloid, which is another protein biomarker that's associated with Alzheimer's, and so they knew that there was something else going on. And there's no literature in the science that that shows that particularly in a 50-year-old man, that, for example, steroid use, which you referred to, could cause this, or any other factor, really. And it is known and has been known that repetitive pounding can create these tangles. That has been documented for decades. And so the doctors concluded that in fact, that's what was behind it. But, of course, the National Football League and their scientists immediately disputed that, mostly because it had never been discovered. And in fact, the NFL's leading doctor, who had done work on boxers, really basically flat out said, look, this has never been shown in a football player, and so therefore I don't accept it. And so that's where the standoff occurred between the NFL and the neuroscientists who were trying to get the league's attention that this was potentially a major problem.
Well, Steve Fanneru, Mike Webster, he was an extreme player. You know, he was an aggressive player. So have you discovered that this is widespread?
Well, what has been found since then? So Webster's brain was autopsied after he died in 2002. The first paper of an NFL player with CTE, which was basically a case study on Webster, was published in 2005. Since then, neuropathologists like Bennett Amalu and others have autopsied the brains of 54 former NFL players. In 52 of those cases, they've found these neurofibrillary tangles associated with CTE. And so they've told us that there are now 52 cases of former NFL players with CTE. There are other former college players, football players, who have been diagnosed with this disease. And there's even a few high school players who have died who have been diagnosed with this disease. The real question now, I think, is how prevalent is this? The neuroscientists who are involved in it will tell you that it's a very selective sample. These are people who were obviously impaired, which is one reason why their brains were donated to science. And so in some ways, they say, it's not necessarily surprising that you would find these issues. At the same time, all these cases, although many of them are very diverse, they all have the same common trait. These are people who played professional football, for many of them, for long periods of time, and they range from Mike Webster, who was 50 when he died and played for 17 years, to Junior Seau, who killed himself in 2012 and was 43 at the time of his death, and also was diagnosed with exactly the same disease. So the question is, how many people have it? And that's what we really don't know. And so you have a lot of people out there saying it's way too early to be alarmist and to fan the kind of hysteria that we're seeing by saying that this is a major problem for football. And there are other people who are saying they believe this is the tip of the iceberg.
Well, you mentioned Junior Seau, and for that matter, Mike Webster. He died at 50. Junior Seau was what?
He was 43.
43. So how can you say that a guy who commits suicide is a result of this encephalopathy?
Well, again, so what people are saying is Junior Seau played football. He played NFL football for 20 years. He played another, I think, 4 years at USC and then another 4 years in high school. So you're talking about 28 years of, you know, of organized football, organized tackle football. Depression is one of the symptoms that neuroscientists have associated with CTE, along with a lot of other issues, basically lapses in memory, problems with anger, delusional sort of side effects. I mean, there's a whole range of symptoms that have been associated with the disease, this disease, and depression is one. And so in cases like Junior Seau, where you had a suicide, or Dave Duerson, who was another former NFL player who shot himself in the chest in 2010, both of those players, after their death, their brains were harvested and then examined, and they were found to have the same neurodegenerative disease. And so, people are not necessarily saying that CTE caused Junior Seau to commit suicide. What they're saying is that Junior Seau played 20 years in the NFL. He was, for most of that time, a pillar of the community in San Diego, a model citizen, a great philanthropist, somebody who was very devoted to his family, and very responsible, and turned into somebody who was completely unrecognizable to his family and his friends and his former teammates, and then ultimately killed himself at the age of 43. And then when his brain was examined, he had this disease. And so I think people are careful to say not that Junior Seau killed himself because he had CTE, but that Junior Seau changed completely in the same way that Mike Webster and these other players did, and then committed suicide. And that is alarming to a lot of people.
We're talking this with Steve Fainaroo. He's the author of League of Denial, the NFL Concussions and the Battle for Truth. Do you equate the NFL and their stance with the tobacco industry and their reluctance to draw the conclusion that tobacco causes cancer?
Well, I think there are a lot of similarities we found when we looked into the parallels. You know, it came up, the NFL was dragged before Congress in 2009, and Lynn Sanchez, the congresswoman from Los Angeles, drew these parallels, and it really was a bad moment in the sort of trajectory of this issue for the NFL, because everybody knows what that means. It means denial and obfuscation and trying to run away from a problem that affects a large number of people. When we looked into it, there were some interesting parallels. One was that, like the tobacco industry, the NFL set up its own research arm, which was designed to look into this problem. And that research arm, which was headed not by a brain specialist, but by a rheumatologist who also happened to be the personal physician for the commissioner of the NFL, determined that concussions weren't a problem in the National Football League, that NFL players didn't get brain damage, that they were almost superhuman. And while this was going on, of course, you had a growing number of neuroscientists who were looking into these issues and were discovering the opposite, that, in fact, concussions were and could be, in many players, a major problem with long-term implications in terms of depression, that the rates of depression among former NFL players were extremely high relative to the general population. The rates of incipient dementia were also, I think, five times higher than they were in the general population. And so you had these people who were publishing papers and were trying to get the league's attention. And then, of course, in a case like Mike Webster and several other former players after him, you had actual cases where players were being diagnosed with brain damage after their death, and the NFL basically tried to just say that was wrong. And so, like the tobacco industry, you had this sort of, you know, official institutional denial that was going on in the face of very credible science that was being done by really reputable people. And I think that a lot of people feel that is similar. I think the analogy breaks down in certain ways when you start to look at the product, right? I mean, the smoking has killed hundreds of thousands, not millions of people in this country. We're not nearly at that place when it comes to football. In addition, you know, football, smoking was like a scourge in this country when we look back on it. I mean, no one misses the glory days of smoking, but football is something that's beloved in our country, and it has undeniably a lot of positive benefits for the society. And so I think if you cut it out and eliminated it, it would be a huge hole in our culture. You know, but I do think from a corporate standpoint, the similarities are interesting.
Well, now you work for a company called ESPN. And don't they make their living off of football?
Yeah.
So how are they reacting?
My employer makes a lot of money off of the NFL. No question about it. I mean, ESPN pays the NFL $1.9 billion a year to broadcast 17 games of Monday Night Football. You know, as Mark and I write in the book, that's basically the equivalent of staging a Harry Potter movie every week. It's like $120 million a game that they're paying for. But, of course, they're paying for it because so many people watch it, and advertisers will pay ESPN a lot of money to put commercials in that content. And then you get not only that, but just the shows and the information. It just draws, the NFL draws an incredible number of eyeballs. I mean, you know, as big as that contract is, the NFL gets, just in TV rights alone, $5 billion a year. So it's a huge, huge thing, and ESPN, of course, is part of that world. But, you know, Mark and I are fortunate to work, as we describe it, for this sort of cubbyhole, this investigative cubbyhole in the ESPN empire. Mark works for Outside the Lines, which is basically ESPN's equivalent of 60 Minutes. I work for the investigative unit at ESPN.com and ESPN Magazine, and there's a lot of overlap there. And our basically, I mean, it's interesting, our charge really is to investigate, in many cases, the very products that ESPN is putting on the air. And, you know, as we saw, particularly with the film, it can create a lot of tension within the company. But I think what we found is that the commitment to the journalism in the world where we operate is total. And we're really grateful for that, because I think, you know, the great irony of it is, for me, is that these same resources that are being generated by the NFL, some of those resources are being applied to our work to investigate the NFL. And, you know, there it is. It's strange, but that's what it is.
Well, it does seem, though, that things are better than they were. That is, give us a brief little update. I mean, I was watching the playoffs this season, and we did see players asking to go back out on the field and being denied by the team physicians.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I do think that there is much more awareness, of course, about this issue. It would be impossible for the NFL to ignore it now, even if they wanted to. And I do think that the commissioner, Roger Goodell, has taken steps many of which had been urged for years, and the NFL had rejected them, you know, to try to get a handle on this problem. And so you do see independent neurologists on the sidelines, which is something that the NFL had rejected for years. You see concussion protocols being put into effect that keep players from going back on the field. But it's not an exact science, and it doesn't always work, as we've seen. You know, just this weekend, you know that the Seahawks are going to be playing the 49ers, and Percy Harvin, who's wide receiver, suffered what appear to be two concussions in the last game and ultimately went back on the field after the first one. Now, after the second one, he didn't come back, and now there's some question about whether he'll be able to play on Sunday. And, you know, people wonder about that because there were several instances this year where players got concussions and then appeared to go back on the field immediately, and that's not the way it's supposed to work. And I do think that so much of this is about the culture of the NFL, really. The players want to play. They're paid to play. Their livelihoods depend on them playing. And, of course, the coaches want them to play, and everybody wants them to play. The fans want them to play. The doctors want them to play. Everybody who's associated with the team and the sport would like to see them performing. And so it's a very, very hard thing to buck when everybody wants that, and yet these injuries occur. And that culture, I mean, one of the things I keep saying is that that culture is not going to go away. It's something that's existed since the beginning of the NFL, and it's something that will never be eradicated because that's the league is built on that culture. And so that makes it even more incumbent on the NFL to try to get a handle on this problem and get people who can step in to make these hard decisions every time when one of these things is discovered or suspected, and try to prevent, you know, some sort of catastrophic injury from occurring. But it's not an easy task. I mean, the NFL, I think, is walking a very fine line right now. You know, they've marketed a huge $10 billion a year industry that is based on, in large part, on the violence and brutality that that exists as part of the game. And now they're trying to convince everybody that they're going to make the game safe. And so how far can they go before it starts to not look like football? I mean, I'm like everybody else. You know, I see some of these penalties called, and I just can't believe it. You know, I'm sort of like, well, no, that can't be a penalty. That's just football. And you see the officials trying to grapple with this. I think it's impossible personally. And I don't know where it's going, but I think it's something that's going to be very, very difficult for the NFL to navigate over the next several years.
And Steve Faneru, it's all your fault. The book is called League of Denial: The NFL Concussions and the Battle for Truth. There's also the Frontline film available on DVD called League of Denial. And I think you've done the world a service. I was just teasing by writing this book and, and by doing your work. And congratulations to you and your brother for this thing. And thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thanks so much, Gary. Thanks for having me.
Well, that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf, but we'll be back again with another program next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You could subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Steve Faneru. His book and film, League of Denial: The NFL, Concussions, and the Battle for Truth. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.